I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, and that is Rescue One CBD. For any of you who have listened to this podcast for the last 8 years, you would have heard my own personal journey from using prescription pills after a knee surgery to finding CBD and having incredible success with that. Now, I'm sure everyone listening is fully aware that we have an epidemic when it comes to the use of nicotine pouches, dip, and other products. Now, to combat this, John from Rescue One has developed a nicotine-free pouch called the Rip Pouch. It's the first and only pouch that contains CBG, nootropics, and B vitamins for both energy and mental clarity. And as with all of their products, is tested to ensure it is 0.000% THC free. So completely trusted for anyone in uniform. And they always send a drug test with their products just to give you guys peace of mind. Now, the pre-sale for this incredible product has just begun and goes on till October 1st. So if you go to rescue1cbd.com, you can register for the pre-sale and make sure it ships the moment it is available. Now, on top of all that, Rescue One is offering you, the listener of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off your order if you use the code BTS, as in Behind the Shield. And you can find all of their products, you can find all of the testing and understand why this truly is a product that you can trust by going to rescue1cbd.com. And you can listen to my conversation with John on episode 1011 of the Behind the Shield podcast. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show surfer and the man behind Surfers Not Street Children, Tom Hewitt. Now, if you haven't heard my first conversation with Tom, it is episode 251, and I highly recommend you listen to that first. In the second conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from the impact of the COVID pandemic on the children in that region, some encouraging signs when it comes to the AIDS epidemic, some beautiful success stories from their program, including Indy, a high-level female surfer, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Tom Hewitt. Enjoy. Well, Tom, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time and coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, it's great to be back. Good to see you, James.
So the last time we sat down, which blew both of our minds before we hit record, was November 2019. It does not seem that long ago. That being said, that was a very pertinent time, you know, for the planet, because that was only a few short months before the pandemic hit. So I think a good kind of, you know, icebreaker would be, what was that experience through your eyes? I mean, obviously, you've got your roots in South Africa. You also, you know, are British. And then how did that affect, you know, Surfers Not Street Children and the children themselves?
Yeah, well, the pandemic period was for, I think, for all sort of nonprofits, it was a pretty scary time. You know, I was actually in South Africa as it was all happening. And we've got programs in both South Africa and Mozambique, and each country was handling things just a little bit differently. And we assume that whatever South Africa does, Mozambique will do sort of a couple of weeks later. So in South Africa, we could see sort of the writing on the wall that there was going to be, the borders were going to be closed. We didn't really know at the time what was coming. I had been in Sierra Leone during Ebola. So I was looking at the stats and saying, what, you know, this is like, that's the risk. This is not going to be much. You know, I really didn't think it would be a very big deal. And so, but as things looked as if there was going to be closures, I was just preparing the staff in South Africa. And then I realized that I actually needed to get across the border to Mozambique and go up there and work with the staff there, you know, just in case. And actually, I was with my son in Mozambique first, and my son Siander, and I left him in Mozambique with my friends, and went back to South Africa. We did some prep stuff. And then I saw they were closing the border. So I thought, oh, man, I can't leave my son in Mozambique during the pandemic. We didn't know how long it was going to be, but I raced across the border and was working with them there. And then that actually closed down quickly. You know, we thought we'd have a couple of weeks, but it was about 4 days. And actually, by then, I actually jumped on a plane to the UK, because South Africa was closed, I couldn't get back in. So I got out. I spent the pandemic, the first lockdown in the UK, but obviously managing what was happening in South Africa with the local team and managing with the local team in Mozambique. It was a crazy time, not least of all because we just didn't really know what was going on. We didn't know who to believe. We didn't understand what was happening. So obviously on the one level, we wanted to be as safe as possible. On the other hand, it was a terrible time for trying to maintain sort of income into the organization. So the first thing we did was to chat with one or two donors of ours who are high net worth, and just say, look, you know, if the shit hits the fan, will you be there for us? You know, we don't know how this is going to play. And a couple of people did say, hey, listen, just get in touch if you need it. And so we actually made it through. And it was a tricky time because, you know, we had to adapt all of our programs. I mean, how do you run programs for the most marginalized in really difficult areas in South Africa if you can't actually meet together? So it presented huge problems for us as an organization, but we worked closely along the guidelines and we actually kept our programs running throughout the pandemic and versions of our program. But it was a horrendous time, I suppose, for many people, but as an NGO, as a nonprofit, it was a really tricky time, but we survived it. And I say survive because we didn't sort of have a blowing up of income, but we did certainly, we got through.
Well, I know obviously how tight it was in the UK until that Christmas party when everything magically opened up again. what was it as far as South Africa and Mozambique? What were the children themselves experiencing as far as the regulations and lockdowns there?
Lockdown was really strict in South Africa and in Mozambique. In fact, there was no surfing allowed. You know, people weren't allowed on beaches. And when we look back at it, we think, man, that's crazy with what we know. It's like, wow, probably the safest place you could have been was in the ocean or on the beach or outdoors, you know. So, you know, with hindsight, we look back at it and we think, wow, that was a nuts period. But it was very strict. And there were the guidelines were, you know, such that you could go to the shops, you could pick up supplies, but you're really limited on what recreational activities you can do. And the police would get involved. In fact, our the director of our program in Mozambique was arrested for surfing, which just seems so nuts.
Insane.
And also the irony is that the kids we work with live in these really overcrowded areas, downtown areas. So actually, the more time the kids would spend on the beach and in, you know, surfing and stuff would be way healthier, again, with hindsight. And well, we believed it at the time, but the rules were set. So it's really different in South Africa. I'm talking specifically about that first lockdown. I went back to South Africa after the first lockdown. I managed to get back straight after that and check in with everybody and spend some time back back there. The UK was weird. I mean, I just worked and sort of in the daytime I was on my laptop as if I was in South Africa, but we could surf. So it was a crazy sort of empty surf like moment, which was kind of weird looking back on as well. But yeah, it was hard for the kids and obviously hard for them to process, you know, these types of things as it was for even for adults as well.
So what was the impact on the children? I've had so many conversations recently, and I always revisit this if we haven't spoken since that time, because after this concluded, I don't know if it was the same in South Africa, but certainly in the UK, the US, it's like, well, let's just not talk about that anymore. You know, when anything else, if you and I are working for a company and we made a horrendous error that cost lives and money, we probably wouldn't be working there anymore, no matter, you know, learning from what we did wrong. So, you know, the ripple effect, for example, on the mental health side, which I know is a big part of what you do with the children, what was the damage that was done by some of these poor choices?
Well, certainly in the South African context, it disrupted the kids' education quite profoundly. It had one major impact on us as a charity in relation to the kids, was that we've always provided a nutrition program, because the kids are unable to, some of the kids are unable to, their families are unable to provide nutritional food for them. And so we at least had one nutrition meal per day, just to make sure they're getting really healthy stuff. And during that time, even the meager income that some of their families had just dried up. So for the poorest of the poor, suddenly there was no way you could even find meager income, even such as begging, you know, right at the bottom of it. So we then had to expand our nutrition program, which was a massive cost. So when we were trying to sort of bring costs down because of income not coming in, we suddenly had to start a whole new sort of chapter, this expanded nutrition program. And, you know, we got 130 kids in the program. And with our nutrition program and food parcels and all these things, we're feeding much more than that, because we're feeding the siblings of those kids, sometimes the parents as well. So these are pretty major. And you could see that the kids just weren't getting the interactions that they used to get, because part of what we do is ensure that every child is back in school. And that's a really major part of the program, because, you know, if you're not in school and you're living around these downtown streets areas, you will become part of street life. And our program is a diversion from street life, and in many cases a rescue from street life. But, you know, during that time, there wasn't really much of a plan for those living in these impoverished areas. So, for example, the sort of the so-called downtown shelters, which are not great places at all. So by not going to school, the kids were hanging out all day at these so-called shelters. So we were fighting to say, well, you know, way better for them to be with us, to come to our program, than be, you know, caught up in street life. So, yeah, it was a crazy time, and had massive detrimental effect on the kids that we could really sort of tangibly see that, you know, missing out on education, not just academically, but also the interactions of being around other kids that aren't living in their sort of the shelter that they're living in, or on the streets in some cases, was a massive gap in their lives.
One thing I've heard from some of the psychologists, and it's just heartbreaking, this is in, you know, the US and the UK, is the schools a lot of times were where outcries would happen, where children would say that there was something, you know, devious going on at home, whether it was sexual abuse or whatever it was. And now they didn't have the ability to report because they weren't in school. So as they came back, a lot of that had been buried down as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think it happened in many, many communities around the world, and certainly in our community. I mean, the very reason we have the program as a diversion program is because if those kids are in those environments all day, all night, the worst that you can imagine will happen to them. That is what our program's about. And although we don't split up families, we do ensure that they're in safe environments when they're with their families. But during the day, you know, anything can happen. And so the more they're in the program, the less they're around the streets. And that was really hampered during that time. I mean, it was at one stage actually difficult for us to even run our programs. And we didn't know if we were, you know, running things according to the law at that stage. It was so complicated. But also there's a level of chaos in the area that we operate anyway. So, you know, we managed to carry on doing our work. And there were some emergency programs such as ours that were allowed to continue. So I think A Blind Eye was shown We just did the best we could during that time, but undoubtedly there have been effects, certainly in terms of, as I mentioned, the kids' education, access to people who aren't in that immediate bubble of theirs. And that's the other thing. We're not able to really comprehend what abuses kids were exposed to because they weren't, there was just more downtime in those really overcrowded areas. Yeah.
What were you seeing as far as actual deaths in South Africa and Mozambique from COVID specifically?
Yeah, look, I didn't see much, to be honest. And one of the I'm kind of angry about COVID, if I'm to be honest with you, about how it all went down. And exactly what you said earlier, that there isn't sort of a truth and reconciliation commission afterwards to sort of sit down and say what was real, what wasn't real, what was manipulated, where did corporations, governments overstep? You know, I think there's so many things that it should be absolutely okay to talk about. Why weren't we allowed to suggest things like herd immunity, and you know, why were certain things dirty words? So I'm kind of like in a, you know, I sit definitely politically much more left, but on this one, on COVID, I what scares me is sort of how authoritarian it was, and that would be and I do feel really angry about many responses to COVID, yeah, I think, just remind me what the original question was. I got off on a tangent.
That's okay. Just the actual impact that you saw, the deaths from COVID specifically.
So the death, yeah. I didn't see much. I did have two friends who passed away during that time. Both were definitely had underlying symptoms, diseases. Both were overweight. So there were two people that I knew that passed away during that time. I don't know. I assume they had COVID. I don't know if they would have passed away at some stage with or without it. I just don't know. But that's what I knew. So here's what I found really interesting. When it first started, and I don't doubt that there was such a thing as COVID. I'm not suggesting for a minute there wasn't. But when COVID first happened, the biggest panic that we had. Now, I worked with street kids during the HIV/AIDS crisis. So, and Durban or KZN was the epicenter of Africa's HIV/AIDS crisis. So I worked with the homeless kids during that time. So we saw death during that. And the biggest fear was that COVID was going to basically attack those with HIV, that their immune systems would be less and couldn't put up with it. And there was absolutely nothing to suggest that it had any impact whatsoever. And I'm not saying that from a knowledgeable scientific perspective, simply from knowing many, many, many people, adults and children with HIV in South Africa, and seeing absolutely no discernible, no difference, and certainly no deaths that could be attributed to that with the people that are in my sphere. And that is still, you know, the number of people in our region with HIV/AIDS is still high.
That being said, aside from, you know, HIV or AIDS, as a whole, South Africa, Mozambique, what is the level of obesity there compared to the US, the UK?
It's quite high. Obesity is high in South Africa, and it's because sugar and carbohydrates are so staple, and also a lot of people are poor, so they're eating what they can afford to eat, and so sugary snacks, sugary drinks, complex carbohydrates, you know, that's what's available, that's what's cheap, and so South Africa is a high level of obesity, and I have heard that. And lots of people did die who were obese during that time in South Africa. I just don't have any knowledge on it myself outside of reading stuff.
Well, this is what I was saying. We were talking before we hit record. I try and stand in the middle and gather as many normal people as possible when I have my conversations. And during COVID, you know, one thing was terminating doctors, nurses, firefighters, paramedics, police officers, etc., because they wouldn't take the vaccine is wrong, hands down. And as time went on and we saw the efficacy became less and less and less compared to what they said it was, that became even more and more of a truth. But regardless, people were fine with these people being on the front line with barely any PPE, with no vaccinations. And then all of a sudden, those same people were murderers now. So that was one where I held my ground and had people on the show and said, this is disgusting. This shouldn't be happening. But another one, which again, heresy, James Gearing, was the whole comorbidity conversation. And it was very simple. Whether you decided that the vaccine was the holy grail of medicine or whether this whole thing was a Chinese conspiracy, the middle ground was the healthier you make the nation, the higher chance people have of surviving whatever this thing is. And so if you choose to have a vaccine, well, you've got to have a healthy immuno response to that vaccine to build your immune system to then stave off this virus. If you choose not to have a vaccine, you need a healthy immune system to stave off the virus, unprotected. So working on the physical health, the mental health of the population became the absolute truth, in my opinion. But again, you know, what you saw was all the things that should have happened were demonized. And instead, people were told, stay in your home, don't see your friends and family, deliver fast food and alcohol to your house, binge watch the Tiger King, and we'll tell you when you can come out, versus go to the gyms, go to the beaches, surf, get sunshine, hang out with people, but don't lick each other's faces and don't go see a, you know, 200-year-old grandmother or, you know what I mean? There was just so many common sense things that were completely disregarded. And it was such a disservice to the gyms, the organizations that you like yours, that truly were actually making people more resistant to this virus by increasing their activity level, improving their mental health, and even the vitamin D element that seems to be pretty prominent now, getting sunshine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, as like I said, I wish there was some sort of truth and reconciliation commission over it, and not to string people up, but rather so we don't make these mistakes again. Because like I said, I'm not debating that there wasn't such a thing as COVID, of course. I'm not even debating that whether it was dangerous or not. Let's assume it was. Where I take issue is there is what I think was a lot of opportunism around it. That's certainly one thing that really bothers me. And also just, you know, as you mentioned, not being able to say certain things or being strung up for saying, I really do believe in freedom of speech. We really should be able to say what we believe. We should be able to ask questions. We should be able to campaign on things. We should be able to disagree. And during that time, I really feel that if you said the wrong thing, you were kind of ostracized. And that's a problem to me, because that's an authoritarian approach. And my worry is that the pandemic period enabled sort of a shift towards authoritarianism, you know, but based on things being in our best interest, safety, you know, keeping safe. And that worries me, because, you know, when things die down, they don't repeal those sort of changes. They keep them in play for whatever the next thing is, because they're actually, you know, useful to people in power. So I just think that there should be a way of looking back on it and really having some, you know, way of saying that was wrong, that was right. Because right now we look at what's going on now. I mean, the vaccines, half of the vaccines are off the market. You know, who would know if, I'm not saying good or bad. I don't know if they're even a good thing. I just don't know. But if we had some sort of, you know, really in-depth, you know, truth and reconciliation commission around it, maybe we could, and maybe we would be a little bit wiser. I guess the question is, you know, for some people, it was a very lucrative time. So, you know, there's powers at play.
Yeah. I mean, for people that, you know, one way or the other, the bottom line is America is 70% obese or overweight. So if it was about health, it was about benefiting the people, we would have seen initiatives during COVID that would change that. You know, bolstering local farmers to create organic food, putting real food back in our schools, bolstering PE programs, pedestrianizing downtowns, et cetera, et cetera. None of that happened. So this is the thing, you know, and even like, you know, I've had people on here that have been in ICUs full of people dying of COVID. I've had first responders in LA talking about, you know, just slinging bodies left, right, and center. But then I've also had Tom Beaver from BeaverFit, who set up one of the makeshift morgues in London that never even got touched. It was, they took it down again. It was never even used, you know. So, and people that were pulled in to respond that had to go looking for COVID patients because their ward was empty. So it's just, you know, of course there were hotspots, but what's the underlying issue of those people? And if it wasn't truly COVID that killed them, well, then great. There's an opportunity to find out, well, what were these underlying conditions that people were dying from? But if you, if it's, you know, vaccines and masks and then that's it, no conversation, then you never cared about the people. It wasn't about the nation's health at all.
Well, exactly. And I think it speaks to an even bigger question is what are our goals as a society? You know, and especially when you look at things like big pharma, what's the goals? Is the goals to make money, or is the goal, which necessitates people being ill, or is the goal to give people better lives, which would be much better if focused on looking at being preemptive, like healthy lifestyles. You know, if we look at the type of food that's being promoted with big food, and, you know, if you look at what's on the shelves at the moment, I mean, it's astounding. And I'm not just saying in South Africa or in the UK or the US, most places there are aisles and aisles of just horrendous food that doesn't really do you any justice in the long run. And that type of stuff could really change. I mean, we could transform. I mean, gyms and exercise and sunlight and all these things that we're now finding out are, well, we've known for a while, but if you combine all these things together, there'd be such less need to rely on popping pills, you know, basically. So I think that the response to COVID was enlightening in many ways, because I think it points towards a societal problem with these big corporations.
Yeah. And I think what we're seeing here in America now as well, it's funny, when as you get, you know, further and further towards extremism in each side of these parties, it becomes a circle and you realize that the left and the right are actually touching.
That's so true. It's alarming, especially like I mentioned that I sort of sit on the left. But in the last few years, I've actually found myself thinking, wow, do I agree with this person? Like, I really like this person now. And that person would be sort of diametrically opposed to me sort of historically, politically. And then I'm thinking, yeah, but they're kind of right on that. It's a strange time.
It is indeed. Well, you mentioned HIV and AIDS. I had a woman on the show who got got HIV through a blood transfusion during pregnancy. I think this was in the 90s, if I got that right in my mind, I think it was. And she was talking about how in the States specifically, camps that were set up for children with HIV, I think have been closed down now because they're not seeing it anymore, because the efficacy of these drugs these days has really, you know, curbed the HIV crisis in America, supposedly. That being said, obviously there's a lot of affluence here. What are you seeing as far as HIV and AIDS in South Africa, Mozambique, and some of the other areas, Durban, for example?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I have a theory, and I'm not a scientist or a doctor. So this is just anecdotal. One thing I have known throughout the last sort of 25, 30 years working with homeless kids in South Africa, in the Durban region and the Eastern Cape, areas massively affected by HIV/AIDS, is that whatever HIV is now, it's not the same as what it was 20, 25 years ago. So what that would tell me, and I've been rebuked when suggesting this to scientists, is that that viruses tend to weaken. That would be my, if I was to look at this without listening to anyone else, I would say, but hang on a second. Like when we were working with kids with HIV, you know, in the 90s, they were dying. But when kids have HIV now, even if they're not on their ARVs sometimes, they're absolutely fine. And a lot of the adults I know with HIV don't take ARVs and they're living their full lives. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second don't take ARVs. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying is that, again, anecdotally, in other words, from what I can see, and that doesn't hold much weight, But just from what I can see, it has to be, my own sort of analysis of it, it has to be weaker. It can't be the same as it was in the 90s. Why isn't everyone dying? You know, because they were in the 90s and we kids on the streets were dying. We're not getting, and even if it wasn't specifically, you know, because obviously with HIV, it's not a specific thing that kills someone. It would be it would be another disease like TB or something that would, you know, it weakens their immune system and then they're susceptible to something else and that would be what kills them. But even that's, you know, not happening as much now. Now, there could be a number of arguments to say, well, maybe there's better treatment on all of these things. You know, maybe people who get TB are treated more effectively now. I don't know. All I can say is from what I see, there isn't the, like adults that I know who have had HIV for 20, 25 years are living their full lives, some using ARVs, some not using ARVs. It's just an observation.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, go back to COVID, I mean, that got weaker and weaker with each variant. So, I mean, that's, yeah. if both of those things are true, then that's incredible news. Because I remember, you know, being terrified in the 80s when it first blew up in England. And I was a junior school boy then, thinking I was going to die of AIDS, not understanding what it was and how you got it. Because I wasn't going to have sex for a long time after that. you know, then I remember on my EMT clinicals, AIDS patients in Orlando Regional in the hospital there. And that was about one of the last times I had patients, you know, as I was a firefighter and a paramedic there on forward that would tell me they were HIV positive, but not those, you know, poor just skeletons covered in the, you know, the scabs that we saw back then. So it's interesting, even in my entire 14-year career, I never saw end-stage AIDS patients, but, you know, I kind of caught the tail end when I was just entering that profession. So even, I'm sure it's more prevalent in some areas, but when I reflect back on my career in the U.S. specifically, which is West Coast and East Coast, I don't really remember full-blown AIDS patients, which you'd think, you know, we would be running on if, you know, we're in the emergency medicine setting.
Well, I certainly remember it in South Africa because it was very vivid on the streets and some of them were children and it was a harrowing time actually. And, you know, sometimes I think you move away from an era so quickly. Sometimes you don't go back and reflect on it. And when I do reflect on it, sometimes I think, wow, that was an intense period, but it did change. And, you know, I don't know why, but it did change. And when AIDS is, or HIV is definitely not a death sentence anymore, but it used to be, obviously. But I think now, certainly in South Africa, if you're diagnosed with HIV, they'll just tell you the course of action with which to live your life, which is pretty exciting. I mean, that's incredible. And like I said, I know people who you know, were HIV positive right in the sort of like 90s in the middle of it. And they're actually still alive, you know, and that's incredible as well, because we assumed at the time, I mean, I think most of them, when they first were diagnosed, they thought that life would be short, but they're living fairly long and full lives, which is really exciting. And again, just, I don't have the scientific knowledge on it. You know, I'm not a scientist or a doctor, but I just see sometimes when you see things, you know, these people who are struggling with these things every day, you know, for years and years and years, you just think to yourself, oh, maybe it is weakening. Or you have these sort of, you know, you come to these conclusions. They might be wrong.
Yeah. No, it's still optimistic, though, regardless. I want to kind of go down, you know, towards the nonprofit and what the kids are doing now. But just before we do, you mentioned Ebola. This is interesting because when I was in, I think it was Orange County, so this would have been about 10, 15 years ago now, there was a pseudo outbreak in America. And all of a sudden we had these, you know, like class, whatever it was, hazmat suits, you know, the biohaz suits. And, you know, if there was any kind of inkling of any sort of, sequence of symptoms, and we had to suit up completely, never broke it out the bag. So that was obviously a good thing. But talk to me about what you witnessed as far as the impact of Ebola there, because from what I understand, that was a very opportunistic disease as well. And if you have, you know, impoverished people, for example, that's where it was really taking hold.
Yeah, I was in Sierra Leone. I forget the year. It must have been around 20, 2014, perhaps, or 2012 or 2014, somewhere in that region. And I was actually looking at potentially setting up Surfers Not Street Children in Sierra Leone as well. And I'd met a group of kids who surfed in a place called Bure down the coast. And, you know, I'd done a bit of work in the capital looking at programs there. And when I was there, it broke out in Freetown, the capital. And it was extraordinary, actually, because suddenly people were, you know, weren't shaking hands. And it was quite a, there was a panic. And I was actually attending some events with the High Commissioner. No, he was a former South African, a British High Commissioner to South Africa. He was doing some work in Sierra Leone at the time. And I was actually traveling with him. And people were panicking. And everybody started trying to get out of Sierra Leone, and the borders were going to close. And I managed to have a partnership with British Airways, and they got me on the last BA flight out of Sierra Leone, left all my surfboards there, which was cool for the locals. But it was, that one was scary because, you know, if you get Ebola, your chances of survival are much less than other diseases. I mean, that is a really serious disease. I'm not saying that others aren't serious, but this one is, you know, it's a terrifying disease. So I got used to that idea of, you know, not shaking hands, and people were starting to wear masks there, not massively because they hadn't been sort of mass produced. That's why when COVID started, I was kind of like, doesn't seem, the statistics don't seem that crazy on this one. It was really because I'd been there at the beginning of the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. And that was actually closed down after I left. It was closed down for over a year, I believe, Sierra Leone.
I had a guy on the show a long time ago now, amazing conversation, Ishmael Bey, and he was a child soldier who was, you know, caught up in the Sierra Leone conflict, and his parents were murdered and forced to fight. And then he was rescued actually by an American Red Cross woman in the end. And now he's a UN ambassador trying to help, you know, other, you know, children that are forced into war. Yeah. When I reflect on a lot of places in Africa, sadly, we only hear them mentioned when there is some horrendous, you know, intertribal violence or, you know, whatever the thing is. What are some of the success stories of some of these African nations that maybe in the past had this very, you know, horrendous history?
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, obviously, and you know this as well, but it's such a large continent, and there's so many. It's such a wealth of culture and diversity, and there's been just incredible minds across the continent, philosophically, academically. There's so many good things that have happened. I think we often, I think our media, certainly our Western media, is pretty slanted, and you know, Africa comes up if there's a disaster. And that's pretty bad, really, because, you know, incredible things happen on a daily, and Africa leads the way in certain, in many things. And so the philosophies that are prevalent across the continent have so much that we can learn from in Western society. And there's also, I think, just a communal, and I can't speak for the whole continent, obviously it's a massive continent, but in the African communities that I've been exposed to, the idea of community living can be really beautiful. And there are areas where it isn't, because things have gone wrong. The socioeconomic scenarios have impacted to a degree where those things are destroyed. But in many areas, there's still just beautiful things happening within a communal context, which, you know, sees much more of a bond than just the nuclear family. I mean, just take, for example, the South African philosophy of Ubuntu, which Desmond Tutu was such a champion for, but really is across the entire, all of the tribes of South Africa. And that's the idea that a person is a person through their relationship to other people. So it's not I think, therefore I am. It's I am because I believe, I participate, I share. And I'm actually sort of quoting there from one of Desmond Tutu's books. But that's a very good sort of, he had a very good understanding of what Ubuntu is. And I think those types of things are really useful philosophies and do get practiced. And also there's all sorts of inventions and ideas that come out of Africa. And actually, if Africa's, you know, given the chance, Africa can usually come up with solutions for African problems as well. Often the solutions that come externally aren't necessarily there to really benefit Africa. They'll also sort of external interests will be pandered to. So I think you could certainly have, you know, a wealth of positive news coming out of Africa if the media was interested in that, you know.
There's a Desmond Tutu quote I use all the time, and it's initially to underline what's going on in the first responder professions here. But again, we're talking about first world problems still. But he says, we spend so much time pulling people out of the river, we forget to go upstream to find out why they're falling in the first place. Yeah, and I love great. That. And what that makes me think of, if we're talking about exactly, you know, what you're underlining at the moment, when I heard the backstory of Somalia and the kind of birth of the piracy, it came from overfishing from other nations on their water, supposedly. So now you have these fishermen that were feeding their families, that were making money, now aren't. And, you know, I think none of us would be immune from, you know, stealing and maybe even, you know, mugging if it meant keeping our family alive. So, you know, knowing the colonization of, you know, the background of a lot of these African nations, this violence, this you know, the negative press that we see, how much of that is actually really at the root cause because of nations from other countries and their impact on that country?
Well, dare I say it, that is exactly the same with the migrant, the sentiment around migrants. I mean, you know, whether it's the UK, the US, many countries where there's a massive backlash. I mean, in the UK, it's just this crazy whipped up frenzy about migrants. I mean, basically, it's really politicians that are doing this to have a rally cry. But, you know, and a lot of people already know this, but if our countries treated their countries better, it wouldn't be such a flow of migrants. You know, they really wouldn't. And this is the crazy thing. You know, we can say nothing about the relationship that our countries have with these countries, but God forbid life becomes terrible or even just unpleasant there enough to want to go somewhere else. And suddenly they're in our country. Oh, hang on a second. No, we don't want them. It's changing our, you know. So yeah, I think it's there's got to be some self introspection. Is that the word? Yeah, some reflection.
I've made that comment many times because it's just so apparent when you're talking about drug prohibition. That was started in America, Harry Anslinger in the 1930s, the whole reefer madness thing, and then obviously it's now an 80 plus year longitudinal study of how not to treat addiction, basically. But you know, when you put addicts into the hands of the underworld, you create gangs. You created the Crips and the Bloods to the level of, you know, that they became. You created the Mexican cartels, the Colombians, you know, all these different things that then destroyed their own countries. And then people are all up in arms in America about the Mexicans coming over the border. Well, it was our policies that created a lot of the issues that they have in their country in the first place. So where is the conversation of, you know, if you really, you know, love where you live, you're not going to feel the need to flee. You might want to integrate and cross borders and share, you know, occupations and skills and knowledge. And, you know, because again, borders are made up by man as well. But the ownership of what we have done to create these migrants, I think Haiti is another good example. It's on my doorstep here in Florida. And we're sending all these weapons to, you know, to Israel at the moment to kill, you know, children in Gaza. But then we're turning a blind eye to helping an island that's literally at our doorstep here in Florida that is tearing itself apart. It makes no sense to me. Dominican Republic is the other side, you know, living just, you know, beautifully and is a huge tourist destination. The other side of that tiny island, you're telling me that the US couldn't have stabilized that decades ago? And if they were happy and employed, how many people would be going on flotillas trying to get to the Florida coast? Probably not very many.
Yeah. It's so true. I mean, we create these problems and then we really loathe the people who run from the problems. But I also think that politicians are really awful in how they use these. They don't really have any rally cry because some politicians, they don't do anything. So they just want to be in power. And so the cheapest rally cry is to tell them that all your problems are not because of sort of the top end taking stuff. That's not your problem. The problem is because these migrants are coming in and taking your jobs. The migrants are the problem. It's such an easy rally cry. And they use it unashamedly. They use this rally cry of how they're going to get rid of the migrants. Everyone says, yeah, get rid of the migrants. It's taking our jobs. They're not taking your jobs. You don't even want to do those jobs. You know, I can certainly speak for the UK. The jobs that migrants have been doing in the past are jobs that the British people didn't really want to do. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but generally the migrants weren't taking their jobs. And if you go around England today, if you were to read social media, you would think that it looked like somewhere else in the world. It really doesn't. That's just not true. And so this idea, this migrant thing is just like this hot potato that gets people riled up, and then people have political success with it. It's terrible, really.
Yeah, it's the cup game. You're too busy looking for the ball under the cup to realize that the person moving the cups has taken your money.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, just seeing as I kind of open that door just briefly, and then we'll go to the nonprofit. I was so proud, and it sounds patronizing because who the hell am I? But to see the courage of the South African people talking about the atrocities in Gaza early on, the same with the Irish people, two nations that understand oppression, as do, you know, many. I mean, I've always point this out. The British people were at some of their highest levels of poverty during slavery, for example. So the average Brit did not benefit from all these atrocities around the world either. You know, so they are, you know, arguably not complicit to most of these. But what I'm so disappointed about, you know, my people, the British, because when we were young, and I talk about this all the time, you know, we had Blue Peter and Comic Relief and Live Aid, and we were a courageous, altruistic nation. And what was going on there was just wrong. And, you know, my grandparents fought in World War II against the same kind of atrocities. And I think they'd be nauseated to see the cowardice and the lack of backbone to stand up, regardless of, you know, the religion or the flag or whatever. When something is wrong, something is wrong. So what were you seeing as far as your nation standing up against that early? Because it was beautiful to see, you know, in a sea of such denial and apathy from the rest of the world.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been in South Africa most of my life. I'm British originally, but South Africa is home, and South Africa is in my blood. And my wife is South African. My kids are dual nationality. And look, one thing I can tell you about South Africans is they recognize apartheid. They lived through it. They saw it. They know it. They know the implications. And when they see it elsewhere, they recognize it. And that is why South Africa has been so vocal. How could you not speak out as a nation when you see apartheid elsewhere, if you had apartheid, if you knew apartheid? So on one level, I think it's absolutely fantastic that they spoke out. On the other level, I'm actually not surprised, because it's inbuilt in South Africans' DNA to know the pain of apartheid and also the struggles. I mean, South Africa struggles with things today. I mean, anyone in South Africa would admit that straight up, that there's many, many problems that South Africa grapples with. But when they know their history, and they know how insidious apartheid was, and how wrong and how destructive of a path it is. And so speaking up on behalf of the Palestinians would be the natural thing to do for a South African.
Where I struggle is I just don't understand where that loss is of right and wrong. And there's a lot of people that claim to be, you know, from a certain religious doctrine. And I really haven't come across any that preach hate and, you know, murder and enslavement, all these. Pretty sure that Christianity, Buddhism, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The reason why they've lasted all this time is because they talk about community and love and compassion and all these other areas. And, you know, a good example is when I was young, this is kind of funny. I went to the cinema in one of the towns where I grew up, and there were two screens back then. That was it in England. And I went to see RoboCop. And when I was young, I looked even younger. And I think I was about 12. And so, you know, I went with an adult and they were like, yeah, no, that kid's not going to watch your RoboCop. And the other screen was Cry Freedom, Steve Biko's story. So I ended up going to watch that. And, you know, does that story say that all white people in South Africa are evil and all black people are angels? No. But of that particular story and, you know, all the deaths in the prisons back then and, you know, the you know, invading all the shanty towns, all those things. I mean, you just saw what was wrong, you know, and the British have a huge part in that, you know, nightmare. The Dutch have a huge part in that nightmare. But you can still stay at that moment, this is wrong. You know, was there this back and forth between the Palestinians and Israelis for the longest time? Yes. Does that make it right? No. You can, you know, you're not saying that one group is an entire group of angels and one is the devil. But in this instant, this is wrong. In, you know, the innocents killed on October 7th, that was wrong. As a human being, you have to separate yourself from religion, from, you know, nationality, and just take off the glasses and go, that is wrong. And that's the voice that was so absent in a supposed, you know, faith-based nation that you didn't even have the courage to do exactly what Jesus or Buddha or some of these other people that you believe in would be flipping tables about.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think this is so, what's shocking about Gaza is how obvious it is. I mean, it's not, it doesn't matter how many times you hear a refute. The images you see, they're not lying. I mean, we all know. We all know what's happening. We all know the numbers. We all know that the numbers are not made up. I think that even someone who's maybe philosophically on the other side and is saying, you know, it is a lie, they maybe they convince themselves, but deep down, they have to know. And so that's what I find astounding is how in plain sight it is. And also, is there any other human beings on earth that this could happen to and so little would be done about it? I mean, Palestinians, I mean, to be born a Palestinian in Palestine in this era, wow, that's really something, because you're not really afforded a place at the table of humanity. And that's what I find shocking. And you know, the money that goes into campaigns to tear down any natural response, empathy towards the suffering of Palestinians is utterly incredible. I think, you know, when I look at this part of my lifetime, we can only speak for, you know, how we view things ourselves individually. I see through the lens of my own eyes. What I see, having lived through this COVID period and this war on Gaza, the genocide, is two extraordinary moments in history for very different reasons, but just absolutely extraordinary that as I will hopefully be sitting in my 80s or 90s reflecting on these and other periods of my life, I will look back on it probably shaking my head, how on earth did those things happen? And obviously the Gaza stuff is just, you know, how did it even continue for a week or two afterwards, after October the 7th? How did it, you know, to still be going now and for the goalposts to be changing the whole time? You know, it's actually unbelievable. And for people to come on and for government ministers and others to be sort of defending it, that's just extraordinary. It's just, it's hard to really fathom.
Well, we're arming them. My nation, yeah. America, is literally paying for the weapons of mass destruction in the same kind of thing that we were sending people into Iraq to fight. We're sending to Israel for this. And the example I've made, and again, this will resonate to when we were young, you know, the troubles in Northern Ireland. You know, they were bombing the mainland. Was there a backstory to that? Absolutely. You know, again, were the British, you know, doing some horrific things prior to that to the Irish? Absolutely. Again, were all Irish angels and all British evil? Also, no. But imagine if they bombed, you know, one of the high streets that they used to when we were young. And our response, the British response, was to go in and level the entire city of Belfast, men, women, children, doctors, nurses, paramedics, firefighters, the lot, and then bulldoze the entire city and then starve whoever's left to death. Would the world turn their head to the Irish? I highly doubt it. They're no different than the Palestinians.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an extraordinary moment. And I think I've always, almost every day that goes on, you can't imagine it could get any worse. And the most disappointing thing is just how much worse it does get. You know, that's just, you know, I think back to sort of in the early weeks of what was happening in Gaza. You're like, you know, you think to yourself, well, man, this response is so extreme. Yeah, I think they've even overdone it for their own, you know, it's going to expose what they're doing. And yet we sit here a couple of years later and it didn't at all. It just got worse and worse and worse. And I think that's the scariest thing.
Absolutely. Well, shifting then to what we can do, like people listening now, obviously what you're doing with your own hands, you know, in South Africa and in Mozambique, you come out of, you know, the pandemic. Talk to me about that upswing. And then let's start kind of diving into some of the incredible kids that you've got on the competition circuit now.
Yeah, so we've got, so Surfers Not Street Children is an organization that empowers kids that are either living on the streets or living in the downtown area, an area we call The Point in Durban. And this area is one where street life is ever present. So, you know, you can be on the streets or you can be living in homeless shelters or even living in an apartment, usually an overcrowded apartment. And the minute you walk out your door, it's street life. And so if you don't have some sort of mentorship through that, the streets will likely get hold of you in one way or another, whether it's drugs, whether it's prostitution, whether it's gangs, most likely gangs. And whatever that is, it's really, really difficult for kids to grow up without being affected by street life. So what we run is a program based around surfing that fuses surfing with mentorship and care and basically provides everything from a diversion from street life to a rescue. So some kids who are completely caught up in street life, whether they're street children or in gangs or prostitution or whatever it is, it's a rescue program for those kids. But at the same time, kids who aren't involved at all that could potentially be involved, it's a diversion program. And actually, as we reduce the number of kids who need to be rescued, the most important thing becomes ensuring that every one of the children has access to diversion so they don't have to become a casualty who needs rescue. So that's really where we're at the moment. So we run programs from two bases in Durban, one right on the beach and one a few blocks back. The beach base we call our surf club, and that's where the surfing happens every day down at the New Pier, Durban's premier surfing wave. And it's a great place to be a surfer, really. It's a fantastic wave. It's a good community of surfers. We're right there at the New Pier. And then four blocks back, we have what we call the Surf House, which is our HQ, where most of our programs happen. We've got a high-speed sort of computer lab where kids can do their homework and get assistance with their school studies and play games and have downtime and hang out together and just have a home from home. And really, this is a way of them spending less time in the streets and more time around positive, a positive team of people who inspire them. So it's exciting. We have about 130 kids in the program at any given time, and you know, 130 core kids in the program. And we're open 7 days a week. We run a nutrition program, health programs, back to school program to ensure that every child is back in school. And we really try and fill the kids' day with school activities, with school, with surfing, with mentorship, so that by the time they do go home to their areas, they're so exhausted, they get a bit of time with their parents, they can catch up, and then they sleep and then hit repeat the next day. So it's been really successful over the years. We don't have a 100% success rate, of course. We're dealing with trauma and addiction, and yes, it's not easy. But we've had kids come through the program and go on to be all sorts of things, from lifeguards to working in surf shops, working in restaurants, coffee baristas, and yeah, a number of different professions, which is exciting to see over the years. And some have come back and are assisting, and our team of fully qualified lifeguards, our water safety team, are all kids who've come through the program, which is really lovely to see. And yeah, it's exciting part of Durban, and funnily enough, something that I think most of Durban is really proud of.
I've had a few people on the show who have used surfing for kind of mental health therapy when it comes to military first responders. So One More Wave in America, and then Surf Well, which is a bunch of police officers in the UK. And I want to circle around to, I know we talked about this last time, but I think it's so important. Talk to me about the impact of a surf session with the community out in, you know, the salt water and sunlight, and then how that is enabling you to then get the kids to open up as they sit on the beach afterwards.
Yeah, look, I think surfing in and of itself is therapeutic. It has its own therapeutic value. And I think that that's not just because you're out in nature, you're in the ocean, it's beautiful, it's serene, you know, all sorts of things. I think that is real. But I, as I try and analyze it, I think that there's something to be said for the moment of riding a wave. The moment of riding a wave, you're absolutely forced to live in the moment. You can't ride a wave and be thinking about other stuff. You just can't. It forces you. The flow of being at one with the wave forces you to live in the moment. And that's the addictive part, because sometimes you know, people will say, well, just being out there, that's what it's all about, just being out in nature. And I actually kind of disagree with that, because for me, I find the ride itself just so addictive. So when I kick out of a ride off the top, I paddle like crazy because I want to get back out, because that's what I want, that feeling again. So although I love being out in nature, and that is therapeutic, there's something about that slightly addictive feeling of being in the moment. There's something really special and therapeutic about that moment that you just want to do again and again and again and again. So with that sort of value that it has sort of intrinsically, I think it's a really good fit for social programs, especially if you're fusing it with mentorship and care or psychosocial care. So I always say that in and of itself, surfing probably isn't enough to change the kids' scenarios on its own. Like, we've had kids that, you know, get into surfing and don't get into the program, and they carry on in street life, and it doesn't last very long. So even though it can bring them some joy and some stoke, and, you know, it's good for them in a sense, I think it's the fusion. It just works really well as part of a model. So our model is fusing surfing with mentorship and care. And I think that in those types of, you mentioned the other organizations, I'm sure they're finding similar things, that surfing isn't the model, but it fits the model really well. And sure, I reckon you could recreate this with high intensity sports where you live in the moment. I'm sure you could do, I mean, skateboarding, I know of programs that use skateboarding. I'm sure you could do it with things like high adventure, like whitewater rafting or whatever it is, you know, I'm sure you can. But for some reason, surfing fits it really well. And maybe that is because of the added sort of side benefits as well, like being in nature and the colors, you know, the blue of the ocean, the greens of the palm trees. You know, there are added sort of elements that make it even more therapeutic. So that package, in a sense, that it creates has meant that we found it to be an incredible tool within our programs. And might I add that we didn't start the organization when I started it in 1998, actually. When I started it, I didn't think of surfing at first. I had an array of different programs, and surfing wasn't one of them. And the idea, and it wasn't called Surfers Not Street Children then, it was called Durban Street Team. One day, and I may have told this in the last time we spoke, but I was surfing at one of the piers in Durban, the new pier actually. And one of the kids wanted to surf with me, and he was on the pier, and you can talk to people. They're quite low piers, so you can actually have a conversation while you're sitting out back. And he said, oh, let me surf. And the waves were tiny. So I let him, I said, jump off. I knew he could swim. And I pushed him into waves, and he was hooting all the way to the beach. I'm sure I told this last time. But the fact remains that he enjoyed it so much. I could just hear him and he wanted to go again and again. It was like this light bulb that went off. And I was like, yeah, I hadn't really wanted to put my surfing into the program because I thought, yeah, that's kind of my thing. And I wonder if I don't really want to impose my, yeah, maybe they want to do other stuff that the kids there already like, you know, I don't want to think that I'm pushing what I like on the kids. And they got so into it. All they wanted to do is surf, and it became our. So we started the program within what we had, and we were doing football, drama, art, all sorts of things, and we still do those things. But surfing just took off as the one that the kids. It just captured them and their imagination, and they were this first group of black surfers in the region. They were like gladiators walking down the pier. It was amazing. You'd find the kids walking down, and surfing hadn't been accessible to the black communities. And so as these black kids would walk down the beach with their boards along the pier, it was obvious they were going to jump off, and suddenly a crowd, and I'm talking in the 90s here, which is only a few years after, you know, the first free and fair elections, you know, crowds of holidaymakers, because Durban's a big holidaymaker spot, particularly for the black community coming from the rural areas, and they hadn't seen this. And so they would gather, and the kids would be jumping off the pier. They'd spend like 20 minutes sort of basking in the glory, like these gladiators about to go out and do battle. And then they'd somersault off the pier and go surfing. And they were like these heroes. And it was an extraordinary moment to watch, because they were the first black surfers after apartheid, at least the first black crew of surfers. There was one or two who before them at that beach, but not many. And so it was a new thing for the community, and the kids just fell in love with surfing. And I'd say South Africa is certainly one of the countries that leads the way on the transformation of surfing in our region, particularly the KwaZulu-Natal and Durban area has been, you know, has really led the way on transformation within surfing. And there's a lot of really, really good black surfers within South Africa. And not just surfers who've come through our programs, but up and down the coast. Mikey February is one of the best surfers in the world, and Jose Faulkner, and then Tandem, CB. We've had kids from our program who've represented South Africa at the ISA World Junior Surfing Championships, which is incredible to think. Kids who've sort of been born into pretty much abject poverty have come through the program, been able to earn their green blazers and represent their country. So yeah, it's exciting. And actually, funnily enough, this year, the World Junior Surfing Championships is happening, we think, in Peru in December. And we've got one of the kids from our program who's qualified. So he's in the South African national team, a boy called Melo. And actually, the team manager is a guy called Sisonke, who's one of our staff. And he's now getting his green blazer as the team manager of the national junior surfing team. And on a personal note, I'm also stoked because my son made the team as well.
So, oh, brilliant. Is that the same son that's doing the modeling?
Yeah, that's my eldest. Sabello does the modeling.
Okay.
And Sienda's the professional surfer. Yeah. But it's incredible that the kids from the program and a girl we're going to talk about in a moment called Indy, she's also been selected twice to represent South Africa at the World Surfing Championships, Junior Championships as well. So, yeah, it's exciting to have seen and sort of been part of this great shift in South Africa within surfing, and also to have surfing as a sport impact the country and impact sports within the country. It's been exciting to see.
It's amazing how powerful sports can be. I think, you know, the South African rugby team, you know, did some powerful things when it came to that integration and telling the world, you know, what South Africa should look like versus the kind of, you know, the white version prior to that. But the program really reminds me of, I think, something that we need more now than ever in, you know, in the US, in the UK and other areas. I hear over and over again, well, the problem is it's these broken homes. And my whole thing is that, yeah, but you can't unbreak a home. Like if a home is broken, you know, and there's so many people in my profession, you know, I'm you know, my second marriage, you know, my son grew up as in a home of divorce, you know, and we're lucky, you know, both partners were still involved. You know, the mother and the father were still healthy and present. But as a paramedic, as a firefighter, I've seen those homes. dad's in prison, mum's an addict, and grandparents are raising them, or whatever it is. And so, you know, to me, it's like, okay, well, these exist, full stop. So what are we going to do about it? Well, what you do is firstly, you take care of your own home, and then you step outside your front door and you go, how can I be a mentor in my community? And I think this is exactly what we need, not this divisive nastiness that we're hearing in so many of, you know, these air quotes developed nations at the moment. But, you know, it takes a village. And if a child has been born into an environment that is not setting them up for success, and they're in an area that maybe they might get pulled into gangs or prostitution or some of these negative areas, then it's up to the rest of us to, you know, encircle them and then steer them in the right direction. This is what you've illustrated so beautifully. A lot of these kids that you talked about that are in this World Surf League now could also have ended up, you know, overdosing on the streets, or, you know, dying in a gang-related, you know, shooting or whatever it was. And the only difference was those kids were met with a positive role model, positive group of mentors that took them in a different direction. And understanding that all of us were giggling little toddlers once, and it's the environment that dictates if you end up, you know, as a Crip or a Blood, or, you know, the world surfing champion, whatever it is simply the other people around you. And I love, you know, what you're doing and so many other people that have come on the show is be part of the solution. It's that simple.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And I also think that probably, you know, there's many heartwarming moments when you're doing this job. There's also harrowing moments because some kids don't make it, of course. But heartwarming, probably the most heartwarming moments for me is when you see the joy on the face of the parents when they see their child succeeding. Because obviously our goal is not to take over the responsibility of parents. Our goal is to empower the parents to add value to what they're already doing, because most of them love their kids. Most of them live in very, very complicated social scenarios. Things have gone wrong often. But deep down, they love their kids, and they might be struggling to do parenting. But if you can assist them in ways that relieve some of the pressure, but also don't take away their agency and their ability to be there for their own children and be connected and be loved by their children, then actually that's exactly, you know, it transforms the kids, and that's what they need. And so we've had kids that are successful in things that you wouldn't even necessarily think are massively successful, but given the context of which they're coming from, are just huge. And the joy and the dignity on the faces of the parents when they see that their kid didn't go into the gangs and, you know, went on to work somewhere, or, you know, didn't hang out on the streets or in the games rooms where the gangs are. They come to the club and they got a fifth in the surf contest, you know. It's just so beautiful to see, because one thing I've realized is that people get caught up in the day-to-day of living, and sometimes this can bring out the worst in them. But if you enable them to just have a bit of breathing space, I'm talking about the parents here, mostly all love their kids. It's very rare that someone really doesn't, and it does happen. Yeah, we know the horror stories. But generally, parents love their kids. And if you can give them that space to just scrape away some of the stuff that's clouding everything and to let their kids, you know, empower their kids to develop, the joy that it brings to that family and the glue that it brings that connects them all is pretty, pretty amazing to see.
Well, what you just alluded to a moment ago, that we can't save all of them. I mean, we try to save all of them, but obviously there's always going to be those anomalies that fall through the cracks. This is what I see used to discourage. Oh, well, you know, that one person, you know, that one child didn't make it. They went back to the gang. So therefore, obviously the nonprofit doesn't work. Or food stamps. Well, this is one, you know, we found this immigrant family and they've been using food stamps and then selling the food. So therefore, social programs don't work. And that's bullshit. Like most of them do. Most of, like you said, if you give people the ability to just stand on their own two feet again and just take some of the load off their back, a lot of people will be able to stand on their own again, refine their autonomy. And then, you know, that's going to help forge an even better relationship with their children. And now, you know, you're changing the world, because, you know, I've said this so many times, you truly want to change the world, raise a kind, compassionate, strong child. That's it. That's the next generation. So a lot of these programs, a lot of these nonprofits are doing exactly that. But I see the, you know, when it's coming from a predatory background, usually corporate or political or whatever it is, they'll use those failures to say, see, it doesn't work, and ignore the other 95, 90% that did work, and talking about that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we know the worst of it. So in other words, you know that without any guidance, the worst scenarios that the kids can face, we all know those, we can imagine those, they're horrific. And yes, you can't stop every child from falling into those to those types of pits. But I always say to the team, my colleagues, I say, we need to operate almost with the mentality that if we can just save one child's life, and by save, I mean, give them the power to turn their lives around, you know, give them the agency to do that, then it's worth it. So, because you could definitely focus on the multitude over the years that don't make it, and that could be depressing, sure. But actually, it's not just one child. There are many, many, many kids that have come through the program. And when you start looking at that, you think, wow, you know, it's hard, because you can get despondent quite easily. But if you step back and you say, okay, but any one child or any child that is able to transform their lives makes this whole thing worth it. If that's our starting point, it's much easier to not get burnt out or to feel despondent about it. And my staff, I mean, the team that I work alongside, they're awesome people. And, you know, I basically oversee both countries, but we have local directors who run the show. I mean, Sandile in South Africa and Mini in Mozambique, they're really deciding what happens. They're best placed to work with the kids that are coming into the program and to decide how it's done. And it can be hard, because when you're immersed in that world, I mean, the street life world is really tricky, and there are so many things that are complicated and fuzzy, especially when you're dealing with addiction and trauma. Addiction and trauma, they're not logical in a sense. So you could say to a child, hey, life's not going right for you, we can see that, here's a better alternative, and they don't take it. And the reason they don't take it is because addiction and trauma mean that they're not able to make the logical decision. Because if you didn't have that, the logical decision, if you trusted the person, the logical decision would be embrace, because it's a lot better than what I've got. But when that judgment is clouded by addiction and trauma, that makes life difficult. So when talking with the team, I always say to them, you know, we've got to remember that the kids that are in the worst scenarios with trauma particularly, but also addiction, are not able at the beginning to make the logical decision. So we have to journey with them. And that gap of journeying with them until they're able to make a logical decision is really hard, because you're trying to maybe convince them that there's a better opportunity. They can't see it. And it's because the judgment is clouded, and it's clouded with real things. Trauma is real. And addiction is real. The pangs of these drugs that they take that pull them back into the streets, and the confusion that trauma leaves imprinted on their minds, you know, and it can be really frustrating for the staff. They're like, you know, it's such an obvious, here's their moment. They just have to seize. That's it. There's the moment. And they can't do it. And what we have to say is, well, sure. Okay. But let's keep going. We keep going and we keep going. And hopefully we journey with them long enough for them to be able to make that change. And the other thing we recognize is that our programs, the best scenario of our program isn't the rescue. The rescue is a rescue. It's emergency. It's when a kid has had the worst happen to them and we're rescuing. And it's much harder. The child who's been through that, their adult life will be harder. The best scenario for us is the ongoing diversion. So the kid that does the best in our program is the kid that comes in at 5 years old and stays till they're 18 plus. That's the dream scenario. So we mentor them through the whole of their childhood. And that's our goal. So our teams are out there identifying who are the kids that will be tomorrow's gangster or tomorrow's, you know, exploited child. These are the kids we want in the program from the get-go. Because if we can mentor them, you know, and provide this added value to their family scenario, we can stop them ever getting into street life. And that's the goal that we're looking for. And it doesn't mean we're less enthusiastic about the rescue. Of course not. But it just means we know that if you can save them the trauma and the addiction, they're going to start making the right decisions way earlier in their lives.
I mean, this really kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with obesity, with, you know, addiction and you know, violence here in the US is they are products of the environment. You know, you get these people that are so judgy. Well, if they just, you know, got up at 5 o'clock and ran 10 miles and then ate a salad, they could be like me. But yeah, and I've always said that I grew up on a farm in England. So, you know, I had orchards and vegetables and, you know, livestock and, you know, was baling hay and mucking out stables. So my whole baseline was completely different than someone that grew up in the middle of London, you know, that all they had was, you know, their little flat and computer games and maybe fish and chips. I mean, you know, totally different environment completely. So do you want to forge, you want to move the needle on this? Like you said, it's the proactive element. Like how can you get to people at the beginning? This just goes back to my comment. If you put real food in schools, get rid of all the shit, all the, you know, the soda machine, you know, vending machines, and you have them doing PE, you know, not electively, you do PE like a class, then of course you're gonna make a huge impact on the physical health and the mental health and bullying and grades and all these other areas. But if you just leave it the same and then complain about obesity and watch your healthcare system crumble and then arrest all these people because you haven't given them positive mentors, you know, insanity is doing the same thing, expecting different results. So, you know, only when you create an environment that allows people to elevate themselves that you're going to make change, which goes back to your point. What I did for a living was someone called 911 and we responded. We were the rescuers. What I do now is what you're talking about, is trying to get people, you know, before they ever get to that point, before they ever have that emergency.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I think that one of the areas that we've really opened up to is this whole sort of, I know it's a catch-all, but wellness. Because one thing we've noticed is that the more you look at the wellness of the child, because we want these kids, as I said, to be in the program their entirety of their childhood. So then it's really, there's quite a bit of responsibility on us. Well, what do you expose them to? You know, what is it you want? And that's an amazing opportunity for them and a responsibility for us, because we know from our own lives, and I think it's dawning on a lot of people, that this whole world of wellness can equip you. Not only can it give you sort of much more peace in your current moment of life, but it can equip you for the future. So if these kids, I mean, they have, you know, various different aspects of wellness, whether it be nutrition program to ensure that they're not eating the sort of sugary junk that's available if you have no money, to our Saturday morning yoga class. You know, these are things that that are part and parcel of developing them. And don't forget that if that's part of our program, that means that these kids are doing this every day, nutrition, every week, yoga, almost every day surfing when the conditions are right, which is a lot of the time in South Africa. And so you start adding in all these different aspects of wellness and of health and of, you know, nurturing the kids. And these things, I just believe that these things are so important to ensuring that the kids have the best shot at their adult lives, as well as having meaningful fun and development during their childhood.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned earlier Indy, so let's talk about her.
Yeah, Indy's fantastic. She's so charismatic. She's 18 now. She's come through the program since she was about 8 years old. She was one of the We started this program called Girls Surf 2, and we've always worked with girls, but we wanted to do something really targeted for the girls. It was very specific to the needs of a girl child. We started this about 8 or 9 years ago, and she was one of the first girls to come into that program. and she would have been about 8, 9 at the time. And she learned to surf in the program. We made sure that she was in school and, you know, went through her schooling childhood. And she actually qualified twice for the South African national team. She competed in El Salvador, and I think the other was Brazil, if I'm not mistaken. She did two different ISA World Championships. So she earned her green blazer as a Springbok surfer. But she was also excelling at school, so we were really encouraging her with that. And her sister's in the program, her younger sister as well. And her grades were magnificent, and she got accepted to study international law at Swansea University in the UK, which is fantastic. Great achievement, you know. But of course, coming out of the Point area of Durban, and, you know, maybe she just had to step outside her front door and street life is there. It's amazing that she survived that. That's just unbelievable. But obviously didn't have any means to go to university. So we thought about it, and she's so inspirational to the other kids. She's a real leader. And I think she has like incredible leadership potential for the future anyway, in whatever field. But she wants to use international law as a way of giving back. And so we just said, well, we sat down and thought, we've got to try and make this happen. And, you know, English university is expensive, but we decided we would do a big fundraiser each year and raise the money for her to have a scholarship to study. And we're doing it year by year. And I think once she's in the UK, she's so charismatic that we can do a couple of events for the oncoming years. So we're just worried at the moment about year one. And we've got to raise about £27,000, which is a lot of money. And we've raised about 16 now. And I think we're almost getting to stage where we've got enough that we can start her and then sort of play catch up with the fundraising. So yeah, it's really exciting. And if anyone out there is interested in being part of making Indy's dream a reality, we would really appreciate that. And not just for Indy, I do think it's incredible for Indy, but also for all the girls in the program that look up to her. And it's not to say that, you know, her studying in the UK means that every kid is going to study overseas, but, you know, one child to reach for the stars says to the other children that whatever the things are that they're moving towards, things are possible. And so we really want to make it a reality. She's an incredible, charismatic, very, very funny, talkative. And actually there's a lovely video on our Instagram page by a guy called Mikey Corker, a British guy who's been in the UK, who's been in South Africa. Actually, he's a South African guy living in the UK who's been back in South Africa shooting an edit for us. And he's producing a short film about surfers, not street room, but he did a 1 minute piece about Indy, which is really compelling as well. So have a look at that on our Instagram at surfers, not street children.
Brilliant. Now, if people want to learn more about you, want to donate to Indy, where are the best places online to do that?
Yeah, definitely Instagram. I mean, our website's good, but Instagram's probably the most up to date. And we've got two campaigns running at the moment. We've got Indy's campaign, and we've got this incredible moment for 15 of the children have qualified for the provincial team to represent at the nationals in South Africa. So we were talking earlier about the international worlds. This is actually for the nationals in Jeffreys Bay, a very famous surfing place. So 15 of the kids are going to go down to Jeffreys Bay and compete for the region. But unfortunately, parents pay, and obviously these kids are not in the position to do so. So we've got to find the money for 15 of them to compete. So that's our other campaign at the moment. So you'll see the two campaigns on the Instagram. One is the one for the team, and then the other one is for Indy's education. And we'd value any support, any encouragement would be gladly received.
Beautiful. Well, I've got some closing questions to throw at you if you've got time.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
One that I read over and over and over again, it's a bit obscure, but it was called Pedagogy, pedagogy, I suppose you could pronounce it, Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. And that was really the blueprint to that I used for starting the organization. And then I fused it with I Write What I Like by Steve Biko. And I was very fortunate to have been sort of taken under the wing of Steve's wife, Nsiki Biko, when I was in the Eastern Cape, and also his brother, Kaya. Obviously, Steve had been murdered by the South African state, the apartheid state. And I got quite a political education through chatting with Kaya Biko and Steve's wife, Nsiki, which was amazing. So those two books would be my... Yeah, I mean, there's others, but those two for sort of really foundational stuff are pretty amazing.
Beautiful. Well, I mentioned Cry Freedom, obviously, which tells Steve's story. What about other films and documentaries that you love?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Films, funnily enough, Cry Freedom is one of my favorites. I think the Sarafina as well, which was a play by Mbongeni Ngema, a South African playwright who passed away recently. He was very famous during the apartheid years. And but they made a film of it with a woman called Lelete Khumalo. And actually, Whoopi Goldberg was in it as well, which sounds a little strange for a South African film. But it was obviously to attract, she does well in it actually, it was to attract an international audience. And I find that one very moving. And then as a surfer, I think, you know, I grew up watching films by a filmmaker called Jack McCoy, and he's just passed away as well. And he made a couple of, many incredible surf films. And if you want to get into some sort of old school surf stuff, some sort of late 80s, 90s and 2000s, I would say look up anything by Jack McCoy.
Brilliant. Well, speaking of interesting people, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Wow. I could certainly come up with someone. If I can think of someone off the top of my head right now, I'm not sure. But yes, I'm sure I know many, many, many people I could recommend, and would be happy to do so.
Brilliant. All right. Well, the last question before we make sure everyone knows again where to find you. What do you do to decompress?
Surf, which is great until you're injured, which is what I am at the moment. I had a little injury to my lower back. It's nothing that I won't recover from, but it just takes a bit of time. So normally I surf, but right now I'm swimming lengths and lengths and lengths just to decompress and definitely surfing is that for me. And also I've got three sons and I just needed one of them to surf. They all do interesting stuff and I engage in whatever they're doing. But I've got one son that surfs, and that is pretty special when you can surf with one of your kids. That's a pretty special experience as well.
Have you come across Foundation Training, the back health program?
Do you know what? You're the second person who's mentioned that to me this week, and I'm about to watch something on YouTube about it. Someone said to me that's the app that's, you know, changed their world in terms of their back.
Yeah. No, it saved my career, literally. I hurt my back as a firefighter, and ironically, my chiropractor, who I'd paid out of pocket to go see because the options from my workman's comp was surgery and pain pills, he had this playing in his office. And so I was like, well, what is this? He said, oh, well, you know, there's a free thing on YouTube. I want you to do this before you come see me every time now. So I started doing it, and it works so well that I ended up going and getting certified and teaching my entire fire department, you know, this training technique. So yeah, Eric, he's trained Kelly Slater and a whole bunch of surfers. But I mean, it is incredible. And ideally for prevention, but if you are hurt, it's a phenomenal back train program too. So I highly recommend it.
I will be doing it tonight. That's great to hear.
All right. So you said the best place to find, you know, Surfers on Street Children is Instagram. Any other places for you specifically?
Yeah. I'm also on Instagram, Tom Hewitt, MBE on Instagram. And have a look at our website, which is surfnotstreets.org.
Beautiful. Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much. I mean, firstly, the incredible things that you and your team are doing. I think it's a beautiful blueprint that you don't have to be in, you know, South Africa. You could be in, you know, Orlando or wherever on the planet. You know, I think mentorship is absolutely what we need at the moment. But I also want to thank you for being so generous with your time and coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, thanks so much, James. It's a real pleasure. Great to be back.